Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Some people, you know, have a very dry sense of humor. Some people have a more bawdy sense of humor. But in the end, it's about the connection between you and the person you're dealing with, getting them on your wavelength so that they actually feel more relaxed. Are you more likely to sell to someone who is feeling relaxed than someone who's feeling tense and so on? Well, of course you are.
Welcome to the Humorology Podcast with me, Paul Barros, and my glittering lineup of guests from the worlds of business, sport and entertainment, who are here to share their wisdom and their use of humour with you. Humorology is the study of how humour can dramatically improve your business success and your life. Humorology puts the fun into business fundamentals, increases the value of your laughing stock, and puts a punchline back into your bottom line. Subscribe and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. My guest on this edition of the Humorology Podcast is one of the most influential agents and managers in all of sport and entertainment. He has represented 4 English captains across multiple sports, and his collection of clients includes some of the biggest names in sport and television, including Gary Lineker, David Gower, Mike Atherton and Brian Moore, just to name a few. His influence on modern-day football is undeniable, having been involved in the careers of players like David Beckham, Alan Shearer, Peter Shilton and Michael Owen. He has made transfers happen, created captivating careers for his clients, and even spent a short time as the chairman of his club, Leicester City. When he isn't representing some of the nation's most notable stars, you can find him writing captivating columns in the New Statesman or giving his insights on the behind-the-scenes business of sport and entertainment. Now, we're sincerely hoping that the experience of doing this interview will rank a close second to his beloved Leicester City winning the Premiership. John Holmes, welcome to the Humorology Podcast.
Thank you, Paul.
Good. Is it already ranking a close second to Leicester winning the Premiership?
You want me to be honest, don't you?
No, I don't, actually.
Yes, then.
I'd like to go back to the beginning, John. I know your father was a big sports fan and encouraged you to love sport. Was he humorous, and was humour important and valued in your family?
Absolutely, yeah. He was a massive fan of comedians. I think, you know, he was a great fan of Tony Hancock. I think it was him that took me into Tony Hancock. He also, through his father, who also was a fan of comedians and so on, took me into Groucho Marx, Will Hay, Sid Field, lots of the old comedians. And yeah, watching comedy programs on television together, I suppose, gave me my love of television. My father was born in 1923, so it doesn't take much to work out that he was 16 years old when the war broke out. He spent his 21st birthday on the hill at Casino. Wow. And he would never talk about the war, of course. Because they didn't. They especially didn't talk about Casino, which will lead us into maybe another tale later. But he came out of the army age 22 and tried to play sport because he'd been pretty good as a cricketer, footballer and so on before the war. Not good enough to be professional, but good enough to be a decent amateur. But of course, he was definitely into playing sport at that point and watching sport. He watched Leicester City. His idol was a man called Sepp Smith. My father was at the Wiggiston School in Leicester and was a classmate of Richard Attenborough. And always told me that Richard Attenborough, Dickie, darling, was a massive sports fan. And he too had watched Leicester City at that era and listed Sepp Smith as amongst his greatest heroes. The difference was that Dickie wasn't a sportsman, self-admitted, hopeless. And my father remembers the having to leave Dickie out of a very important cricket team at school because he just wasn't good enough. And you know, that was one of his bad decisions. He'd probably got more cinema tickets or parts in films, wouldn't he, if he'd have put him in the team. And years later, I put them back together again at a ceremony in Leicester when Gary Lineker got his freedom of the city. Richard Attenborough was there. They hadn't seen each other since before the war. So that was extraordinary. Yeah, he was a massive sports fan. He took me to football matches, cricket matches from an early age, and made me laugh on television or helped me laugh on television at Tony Hancock and stuff like that, and also radio comedy as well.
So what was the young John Holmes actually like then? Was he funny? Was he cheeky? Did he already have an entrepreneurial flair?
Yeah, probably was. I was badly behaved, mostly. I think the interesting bit is that my father's generation had, you know, in many ways, their youth was taken away from them by the war. And they wanted their kids to have a good time. They wanted to have a better time than them. And so he generally wanted me to enjoy the sort of sports experiences and everything else that had been denied him. Because of whatever. And I was fortunate. I was born in 1950. The 1950s didn't have much. There wasn't much money about. And then, as someone once said, you know, 1963 came about. I became a teenager. The Beatles arrived. Sex and the Beatles and money arrived about the same time. And you got the swinging 60s. I was a bit young for the swinging 60s, but it was an era of growth, of television, of sport, and so on. And they became my two big sort of obsessions. And my father, who'd worked in the rag trade, his father had started a business during the Second World War, bizarrely, because his father had been just too young to fight in the First World War. He then experienced the 20s and 30s. And what happened, of course, then was the soldiers came back and didn't get jobs and there was a depression. So my grandfather decided he would do all the non-orthodox things. So during the war, he bought a big house when nobody was buying big houses. He started a business that his children could work in when they came back from the war, my father being his eldest son. And he bought a chemist shop in Folkestone because he got it for nothing, because everybody thought Folkestone was doomed. Why have we got a chemist shop in Folkestone? And it only later in my life did it occur to me that this was not only the reason for it, but actually it was a stroke of genius and coincided with the other things that my grandfather did. But what my father did, having come out of the army and gone straight into the family business, sent out with a gown van to sell coats and dresses to credit traders in the Midlands. He didn't want me to have to do that. He wanted me to be able to do what I wanted to do and so on. And what I wanted to do was to write about football. So I wanted to become a journalist. And that was where I started. But then I sort of realized quite quickly after going to university, where I worked on the university newspaper, I quite enjoyed it. I worked in journalism for a bit. I found that the people who worked in local newspapers where you had to work in those days actually hated graduates because they'd not gone to university. And I had a news editor who fancied he was Humphrey Bogart and patrol around the place being actually quite unpleasant to his young staff. And I thought, fuck this for a game of soldiers. And I was in contact with a local businessman, started his own business, and he used to take me out for lunch, and I talked to him about ideas I'd got about sport and so on. And I'd been heavily influenced by a money program, television again, that featured Mark McCormack. This sounds really brilliant. And that was what I wanted to do. And he said to me, why don't you come and work with me? I'll teach you about financial services and money, and you try and build a business in sport along McCormack's lines, which is what happened.
I mean, was Mark McCormack charismatic and thing? Was that what drew you to him? And did he have humour, you think? Or did you think that
this
is what's
missing? He didn't have humour.
Well, that's killed our American audience for a start.
Yeah, it has. Yeah, I'm afraid so. He was charismatic. He was very clever. And what he did was to discover the connection between sport, television, and business, and put the two together and you can make it work, or put the three together rather, and you will make it work. And he, of course, he transformed golf that way through taking Arnold Palmer, a player who was the best player probably in the world at that point, and saying, if you're going to be the best player in the world, you need to play in the world. So let's go over and play in the British Open, which the Americans at that point had been boycotting. He came over. I can remember very clearly Arnold Palmer coming. My dad was a keen golfer. This guy's coming to play in the Open, as we called it. And it was all over the newspapers and so on. And he came over. He finished second the first year, but then he won it for a couple of years on the trot. Golf was starting to be televised. They worked out that golf was a good sport to televise because of the great backcloths that you got in terms of the coastal scenery where the British Open has always been played. And it came off. And of course, the cameras then were fixed, so they couldn't do it as well as they now do it brilliantly. But it drew audiences and so on. So McCormack started managing the top three golfers because they'd seen what he'd done. The top three were Gary Player, Jack Nicklaus, and Arnold Palmer. And he invented this television program where the big three played various courses around the world. And he sold it, I think, to Shell. And it was a TV series shown around the world. The big three play this course, the big three play that course. And I thought this was really clever. But McCormack made one fundamental error in what he said. And his fundamental error was he believed that what happened in America happened in the rest of the world later. It may have been true at that point, but it's no longer true, of course. And if you really want to upset Americans, and you really want to upset your American listeners, you tell them that the World Cup is bigger than the Olympics. They really react badly to that. And if you really want to get them to react like you've shot their grandmother, you tell them there are more films made in Bollywood than Hollywood, both of which are true.
It sounds like that your image was to be Mark McCormack with gags and with humour. as well. That was your image of the future. Would that be fair to say that you've actually pushed the lighter side of it? You've got the charisma, you've got but you've also added in a level of humour. How does that help you?
In most situations, it does help you, doesn't it? If I always say, there was a boy I knew at school who was very lazy, but he always got away with things. He used to irritate me intensely because he just used to grin and he smiled at people. And, I remember this master say, his name was Charlie Thompson. Thompson, have you done your essay? And he just grinned back, no, sir. And he got away with it. And I thought, how does he get away with that? And of course, you can disarm people. They say the disarming smile. And to try and get a smile, to try and get the other guy to grin a bit, it takes them down a bit. It's hard to get cross with someone who's making you laugh.
Well, so you actually think that it's a state change in a way? That you can actually, through humour, you can change people's state for the better and then use that.
Yeah, you can, of course. That you can lighten the mood, you can... if somebody's getting in a rage... I remember a colleague of mine, guy I worked with for a time, Tony Stevens, he originally started acting as Beckham's agent. And when he met Alex Ferguson, to tell him that, Alex Ferguson went into a state of rage because he didn't like anyone having any control over any of his players. And at the end of it, so listening to this hairdryer treatment, he then looked at him and said, "So I take it you're not happy." And I think it maybe brought him down a bit. You do try and break people down. Some of the best managers in sport I've seen were also very funny men. Brian Clough was a brilliant comedian. Bill Shankly had moments of great comedy in terms of the way he dealt with people and so on. And of course, it gets people going with you and so on.
I've heard you describe Brian Clough as the kind of like the Eric Morecambe to Peter Taylor's Ernie Wise, in that he seemed to have a natural facility for humour. Did he always use it kindly, or was it a one-up?
Clough was mostly concerned with power over people. That was his primary concern. If you met him, his idea was to weigh up where you were in terms of power, how strong you were, how weak you are. And he could use humour to reduce people as well, i.e. take the piss out of them to a degree, or build them up. But he was all concerned about his power in relation to them. But he used humour quite cleverly in doing that.
So humour can be used for a cruel aspect as well as the aspect of lightening the mood. And it's a choice. Well, but you've always talked, I think, about that Brian Clough would have been a success in any field. Do you think that humour is the key to great intelligence and great nows? It's just how you use it.
I've met some great people who are pretty humourless. So it's not invariable, but it's a tool, isn't it? It's something that you can use. If you're good at it, you can use it. And I've always found the use of humour quite helpful. I'm not a comedian. I'm not funny. I'm not in terms of, Jimmy Tarbuck is a friend of mine. He's naturally funny. He can do absolutely anything and he can make you laugh. And he tells stories in a way that completely disarms people and so on. I remember one occasion where I went to a dinner in London, Tarbuck, it was anyway an organization, and they Tarbuck was the president, and Thatcher was there after she'd been prime minister, and she was beginning to get towards a state where her brain was she was suffering from early dementia, early signs of dementia, although she was quite old. And Jimmy told a joke about revisiting his honeymoon with his wife after 40 years, and they went back to Southport and they took a walk as they'd done on their honeymoon 40 years before, and they strolled over the sand dunes, and then he said they made love against a fence, and he said to his wife afterwards, God, that was as good as it was 40 years ago. And she said, yeah, but 40 years ago, the fence wasn't electrified. So, and everyone reacted like you did. Thatcher never moved a muscle. And I knew at that point, she's maybe gone, you know.
Well, we've had William Hague on the podcast, and he has said categorically to us that Margaret Thatcher didn't have a sense of humour. So it could just have been that.
Well, it could have been. He has got a sense of humour. And actually, he can tell a joke. Boris Johnson gets away with a lot of things because he can tell a joke. Maybe yeah. Keir Starmer would be more effective. It'd be interesting to hear what Alistair Campbell said about it, if he was seen as a person who could tell jokes.
Well, according to
Talking
Alistair...
Talking of jokes, I've just been joined by a dog.
That's all right.
He wants me to throw his ball. Sorry, Otto. This is Otto von Bismarck.
Otto, what's your favourite gag?
What do you think of it so far? Sorry, I will throw him out. You'll have to suspend at this point. Apologies. Okay. Churchill obviously had great ability with humour and used it in speeches, you know. Irony, those sort of things, some chicken, some neck, you know, one of his famous words and so on. So, and particularly if you go to the House of Commons, if you've ever been there and seen the way it's set up and how they behave at question time, sometimes how that comes over in TV, as opposed to when you see it in reality, it is different. And actually it gets quite childish, and you sometimes worry about, actually, is this the right way to run a country when there are things that are serious and so on? There's definitely a place for humour and a place where humour isn't appropriate. I think you have to work that out.
Yeah, it's interesting, the Keir Starmer point, because we've had quite a lot of people from politics on, Steve Richards and obviously Alistair and everything. And seemingly, I don't know Keir Starmer, but he has got a good sense of humour. I think he's just reticent to actually bring it out because he's terrified of the press jumping on something that could be, you know, humour is very often inappropriate.
Inappropriate. And also, maybe he's playing a canny game in that he's trying to present an opposite. You know, Attlee played an opposite to Churchill in many ways, yet was a very effective prime minister in many ways.
Well, you talk about negotiation. What is the key to negotiation for you in the terms of humour and how it can be used? Is it about good cop, bad cop, as you say, or what is the essence of it?
There's no one good way. That's the first thing you learn. The idea that something is the answer in negotiation is not true. It's all the circumstance. It's where you are at the time. I've negotiated for a living, as it were, for ages and ages. And sometimes people will say to you, how did you do that? Or how did you do that? And how did you get that deal? How did you get that deal? And actually, sometimes good negotiation. Sometimes did I use humor in it? Sometimes, yeah. Did I sometimes play the hard man? Yeah. Sometimes did I sometimes play the naive? Yeah. But there's no good way to do it. It's what's appropriate in the circumstance. It's basically looking at the guy the other side of the table and working out how to. It is, you see, Clough understood it was about power and so on. And actually, if someone's on your wavelength, if they're talking to you and you get a point of contact, it does work. And sometimes that involves humour. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you're keener to get one step ahead of them. Sometimes you're keen to withhold certain information. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the best way to do it is to actually be completely open. But it's all about the dynamic of the relationship in order to achieve where you're going.
I think that's really interesting, because what you have hit on, I think, there, whether consciously or unconsciously, is that you said negotiation is all about different circumstances, but I think it's about listening, which is what the essence of good humour is about listening to what you're getting back and then reacting to it in a way. You're very good at listening. You're very good at gauging what people need at a certain point. And by the way, all the great comedians, I would say, are the best listeners. But listening doesn't just mean through the ears. It means seeing how people
correct.
Look.
I was going to say, I'm often told I'm not actually very good at listening. And a friend of mine always used to say I was permanently fixed onto broadcast. I think it's not only what you hear, it's what you see. You can see in people's eyes, in people's body languages, whether you're getting over to them. You know, are they sitting like that, or are they sitting back and smiling and enjoying it? Are they smiling because they're laughing at you, or are they smiling and grinning because they're enjoying the conversation? So it's watching as much as listening. It's sensing the other side of the table, where you're going to. Is it time for a break now, or is it time to push on?
I think that listening off the top is the, as in psychology, we would call that listening off the top, whereby true listening is about recognizing how someone looks when they're talking to you. Are they with you on the journey? I mean, even the simple things like when people want to hear more, the eyebrows go up. When they want to hear less, the eyebrows go down. And you talked about it being instinctive. And I think that is really useful for our listeners to go, that somebody who has done as many brilliant negotiations over the years is instinctive and doesn't just play it one way. Is humor appropriate at this point? Can we shift the way somebody's feeling and their state through humor? So that, I think, is the crucial thing. And I'm learning a lot from that negotiation stance as well.
You say it's instinctive. It's also learned. You gain through experience, don't you? You try and learn from each new negotiation because you do make mistakes. And you learn, I won't do that again. You know, one thing I always learned with negotiation, even if you've got everything you absolutely want and you're bursting to say, yeah, let's do the deal, you should all say, yeah, I think we're there, but before we come to final agreement, I want to go and talk with my mother, my wife, my dog. I want to always give yourself a get out clause. Because once you've got out of that state where the other guy, you have between you maneuvered yourselves into a position where you think you've got a deal, you need to then go.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Have we really got a deal? Have I missed something? And that, so always give yourself time. Now, early on, and especially when I was dealing with, training people to do my job when I was with a larger bit, I found that some of them were desperately anxious. Yeah, we've got a deal. Right, it's brilliant. They went and did the deal, and then they rang me half an hour later and said, oh, we've got a better deal now. And I'd say to them, well, have you 100% agreed with this guy that you were going to do it? Yeah, I have. So I'm going to let him down. I said, no, you must never let him down, because if you've 100% agreed, I'm sorry, you will never do a deal with him again if you let him down at this point. So always give yourself a get out clause, because you don't know if somebody else may come along with a better deal in the next 10 minutes. You can't forever string things out. But again, that's a bit of intelligence and watching as to, can I string this guy on for a little bit longer, or is he going to lose his humour and his patience and so on? Have I got to sort of bring him down a wee bit? I remember, and it is quite a funny story, Peter Shilton, the first time we did a transfer for him, we moved him from Leicester City to Stoke City. And in those days, transfers were done rather quicker, and all sorts of arcane rules, like you had to lodge the papers on a Thursday night at Lytham St. Anne's. I mean, could you make a more difficult place to do it? And So Leicester and Stoke had agreed a deal. We had to agree personal terms. And most managers assume that what would happen is they would walk into a negotiation, tell the player what he was getting. The player would argue a bit, but then he'd say, well, that's what we pay, and that's it, son. And you can't have any advisors, and you just do this, and we'll look after you. Is there anything else you want? And the player would then meekly say, well, can have a new car, and he'd say, I'll look after that, just sign there, and that would be the end of it. And then the next day, he'd go and say, what about my new car? And he'd say, fuck off, you've signed, and you're playing for me now, son, you're on a 3-year contract. And I walked in with Peter. The club, they came in, there's the manager there, the director there, the secretary there, yet the player was expected to go on his own, and basically they overpowered him. You can't do this, you can't do that. And I said, well, and Peter backed me up, I'm not going to sign unless John says it's okay. So we negotiated, and it took a long time, and they wanted to talk in terms of weeks, because these people were paid employees that you only got, you know, weekly wage. This was what you got. You were like the mill worker, you know. And we talked in terms of annual salary, and we messed about, did all those typical negotiation ploys. If somebody's talking pounds, you say, I want, well, can we denominate that in dollars? And then now you could say euros and so on and so on. So I've done that loads of times. It used to be, you used to have a sheet with all the currencies written if you were negotiating a foreign transfer, so you could mess about with the numbers a wee bit. And so on. But anyway, to cut a long story short, this negotiation went on a long time. And director who turned up, you know, he didn't actually say a lot except to agree to various things along the way, which I made them write down and so on and so on. I could see as the morning went on, we're in a hotel in the middle of Northamptonshire, and there was no refreshments in there, and he was a big man, and he was getting more and more hungry, and he kept saying, well, shall we have some sandwiches now, or some lunch or something? Okay, so, no, I think we need to concentrate on this, you know, we need to get this sorted. And then we got to where we got, you know, we were moving on, and through dividing things up and putting in rates of inflation and all that sort of thing, we got to a summer, I think it was £338, 60p. And he said, oh, good, right. I'll get some sandwiches. So he bought his sandwiches and he got a prawn sandwich in his mouth. And I said, look, this, I went back from annualized amounts back to weekly amounts. I said, this is £338.60. This is ridiculous. Why don't we make it £350? And he's halfway through his prawn sandwich. And he said, and there's prawns flying all over the place. You've got enough. That's it, young man. That's.
I think that by understanding how important humour is, you actually managed to change the image and public perception of sports people in the UK, because you were instrumental in bringing the TV show They Think It's All Over to our screens. On that show, you encouraged both Gary Lineker, if I'm right, and David Gower to take the piss out of themselves and allow the piss to be taken out of them. So how important do you think that is to the image, to be allow the piss to be taken out yourself? Because you started it, really.
Well, I'm not sure I said what the story of Think It's All Over was that on. And a guy phoned me and he said, my name is Richard Addis, I think his name was. He said, I'm a producer with BBC Radio 4. And we're starting a new sports quiz series, which I've been put in charge of, and I know nothing about sport. And I thought, yeah, that sounds right for the BBC. And he said, I'm told by Jonathan Martin, who was then head of BBC Sport, that you know everything. So I said, well, that's very kind of him. Yes. He said, and I think Gary Lineker would be the perfect person to be on, because we're doing a pilot show. And so I said, well, that proves two things. That Jonathan Martin knows a little bit, but you do know nothing, because if you knew anything, you'd know Gary Lineker's currently in Japan playing for a Japanese side. So anyway, so he said, right, oh yes, oh dear. So can you? So I said, well, look, I've got this client. I've got David Gower, who's a client, and I've got Will Carling, who's the England rugby captain client. I think they could do a pilot radio quiz for you, and so on. So we went along, and the panel consisted of Rory Bremner, who's teamed up on one side with Dave Gower, and Rory McGrath, who was teamed up with Will Carling. And the question master was Des Lynam, who was BBC's Mr. Sport at that point of view, and it was done at the Paris Theatre, and I watched it. And I thought it was very funny, and I thought this could work on TV. And I'd always been interested in extending the career of a sportsman beyond 35 into broadcasting and so on, which was the simplest way to do it. Television, sport, McCormack, this is how to do it, grow them out of that, and so on. So about three or four days later, I bumped into Brian Barwick, who's head of BBC, who's second head of BBC Sport, deputy head, below Jonathan Marsh. And I said to him, I saw a pilot of a radio program being done the other night called They Think It's All Over. And I think it could work on TV. And he said, oh, Des doesn't think it'll work on TV. And I said, okay, that's Des's opinion. So we got the two of them together. And we did endless pilots, and yes, and the first night it came out on television, I remember it going out. I think they put it on after the Watershed because of the, you know, nature of it and so on. And then I just finished watching it on the television, and I got a phone call from at home from the editor of The Sun. Now, phone calls in those days from the editor of The Sun late at night were not normally good news. So, and I knew him, it was Stuart Higgins, and he phoned me, he said, it's brilliant, isn't it? It's fantastic. I said, what, Stuart? He said, that programme. He said, it's brilliant. And I knew then we got a hit. What it did was that you saw Gary and David learn next to really good comedians how to deliver a joke, how to deliver a line, how to be funny, what worked, what didn't. Like everything in broadcasting on TV, heavily edited, so they could tell which jokes worked, which didn't, which went into the broadcast programs. About, you know, an hour and a half was done, condensed down into half an hour. And that programme had, of course, a dramatic effect for both of them in that it presented them to the public in a different way as television, beyond just the original sport. How do you feel after winning the World Cup? No, you feel bloody terrible. You know, the stupid questions, yeah. How do you feel? Well, I'm over the moon, Gov. And all that sort of thing. They could actually use that and learn how the comedians did it and so on. So it was a interesting exercise.
But I think, you know, I think you're hiding your light under a bushel, because I think that was a seismic shift in the way sports people were viewed. And allowing that to happen, it had to be an instinctive thing that actually they are going to be more drawn to the bosom of the public if they have humour.
Of course. What happens on television is, of course, the public are watching you, so they're seeing you differently. So your public are observing, and you get the feedback, of course. It was it was still a very enjoyable exercise.
No, and I think you've done all right, John, haven't you?
I've got away with it.
What makes you laugh?
What makes certain comedians make me laugh? Jimmy Tarbuck, who's become a friend, he makes me laugh. Tony Hancock made me laugh. Dad's Army, sitcoms in general. I think what's sad now is that the sitcoms of that era, which were all based in terms of the development of character. It was Hancock's character. Hancock wasn't actually a comedian. He was a comic actor. Maybe the geniuses were Ray Galton and Alan Simpson. You look at the comedies that often in partnerships, weren't they? Willis Hall and Keith Waterhouse were able to write Dick Clement, Ian Lefrenet, the Likely Lads. Brilliant
Orange.
Comedy. Came out of the characters and the development of the character so that people knew and could identify with them. And actually, the interaction of people does make me laugh and so on. Modern stand-up, some of it I think very good, but it's not necessarily the material, but the way. It's the way you tell them, as they say. Tommy Cooper, you know, that sort of thing. He could Bob Monkhouse had brilliant material, of course, and so on, and got a joke for every situation, and had this book and was as slick and witty. It's the wittiness, the response, it's the intelligence of some of it that makes me laugh. Yeah.
You were talking about one of your comedy heroes who makes you laugh, Bob Monkhouse, and in my performing days, I did a big gala show at the Birmingham Hippodrome organised by Jasper Curran. It was like a who's who of comedy, Rowan Atkinson and Lenny Henry and Punt and Dennis and all of us, and my old act, Morris Minor, and the Majors we were on. And the person who blew everyone away that night, and remember, it was everybody was steeped in comedy, was Bob Monkhouse. He was so funny live on stage, and people seem to remember him more as a game show host. But live on stage, he was naughty. He was a little bit, you know, blue, but boy, was he funny.
He's very funny. Terry Wogan, you see, wasn't a comedian, but he was the master of a funny line and a way to react. I remember with Wogan, he did a speech. He was chairman of the Saints and Sinners Club, and they had a Christmas lunch. And every year they got a speaker along. The speaker, generally speaking, was brilliant. They had some very, very funny speakers along. And he got someone over from Ireland. And this bloke was absolutely terrible. He was awful. And he went on for 20 minutes, and in the end, he'd lost his audience. They were almost throwing things at him and so on. And the chap I was sitting next to is my mate who'd invited me. He said to me, "Let's see Wogan get out of this, because this guy is his choice." And Wogan stood up, and because he stood up, he's quite a big man, Terry. He commanded presence, and it just went quiet. And he just looked at everyone and said, "Well, follow that." He didn't put the guy away. He just gently, of course, everyone wet themselves. And it was very, very clever, quick wit and so on. That sort of thing makes me laugh and so on. And yeah, it is about, that's about power over the audience. A lot of it is about power and power. And you're talking about negotiation, which is about power and humour as a way of getting people on side. Some people can't do it, some people can.
Why do people fail to be funny? Do you think that it's in the background? Because I know you've talked about in the past that from the idea of sports people, that team players, people who play for teams, tend to be funnier than individual sports. So what do you think it is that makes people fail to be funny?
Some cases it's autism, but which can in itself be funny, can't it? You know, some autistic people are quite funny. Should one laugh? I don't know. Is it cruel to laugh under those circumstances? But it can certainly be disarming. But it's, as we've talked about earlier, it's your relationship with the person you're talking to and judging it and so on. And some people, you know, have a very dry sense of humour. Some people have a more bawdy sense of humour. But in the end, it's about the connection between you and the person you're dealing with, getting them on your wavelength so that they actually feel more relaxed. Are you more likely to sell to someone who is feeling relaxed than someone who's feeling tense? And so, well, of course you are.
You were talking about just now about why people fail to be funny, and it sounded like that they fail to empathize, really. Yeah. That would be the key for you, is to actually empathize before you can be funny.
Correct. I think if the guy's not on your wavelength, can you get him on your wavelength by using a bit of humor? You know, you're all the time, aren't you, searching when you meet someone for the first time, what can I talk about to this person who he will get on my side. You notice a lot of people, often not very clever people or people who are not sure of themselves, will laugh after they make a very bland statement. What that is, I think, is an unconscious attempt to get somebody on their side. So I'm being funny. No, you're actually not being funny. Doesn't, you know, it's not getting me there, but it's a nervous laugh. And they, unconsciously, they're trying to get the other guy to laugh with them.
Rapport, I think, is the first thing you need before you can do humour. There seems to be an order of things that you have to actually have got the rapport in order to get the person into a state whereby they are going to be relaxed enough to laugh.
And it's risky sometimes. I can remember in my selling days going to meet a guy who he was I think he was a fruit and veg market wholesaler and so on, and walking into his office in Sheffield, and it was a shambles. And I looked at him and I went in and I thought, you know, because sometimes you do take risks, this could have gone really wrong. And I said, God, what a fucking mess. And he looked at me, smiled, and said, it is, you're right. And we got on straight away. So something in me at that point could have gone really wrong, like your bit, that's really rude, go away. But it didn't. You've got to try those things, know where you're trying them and so on.
That comes with charm, doesn't it, really? Because actually some element of your face or your demeanour or your body language is showing people that you're teasing, you're having fun. And I think that's a really important element whereby your face tells a different story. I mean, if you just say the words, you know, this place is a shithole, with a blank look on your face,
yeah,
it's going to die on its ass.
Well, sometimes the blank look on your face can also be effective. It charm is a dangerous quality because you can work yourself into a position where if you can make people laugh, you think you can get away with almost anything. I think we have a prime minister who thinks he can get away with almost anything because people will laugh and so on. It needs to be tempered at the same time with an intelligence of where I'm going with this. You know, I don't want to get too carried away with this, otherwise you'll get out of hand and so on. So humour, temper, it's intelligence, basically, isn't it? And empathy and understanding. And there's also an element of integrity as well, stuck at the back of it, yeah.
Isn't it about self-editing? Because all of us who think funny all think loads of things and then go, no, it's not the right time. No, no, no. Yes, it's the right time. And so, I mean, how many times have you had a gag in your head and you thought, no, it's funny, but it will be cruel at the same time? You're a brilliant businessman who's brought people through the business. If I asked you, because a lot of our audience are business people, if I asked you to write a business case for humour, why it should be included in any business, what would you include in that business case?
Because people work better when things are fun. I think we've proved, haven't we now, that a happy staff, a happy workforce, if they're having fun, if they're enjoying it, even if it's a fairly mundane job, they will work better.
Anyway, John, we've reached a point in the show which we like to call quick fire questions.
Quick fire questions.
Did you like the jingle, by the way?
Wonderful jingle, yeah. Have you tried releasing it as a single?
It it's a it's got number one written all over it. By the way, it was written by the fifth member of Queen, just so you know. It's true.
Is that Princess Anne?
See how we're going. Who is the funniest business person that you've met?
Brian Clough.
Okay. So why?
Quick-witted, fiercely intelligent, cabaret show at times on his own.
So what was it that made him? And is it, for you, is that an indicator of absolute intelligence, the fact that he was so funny?
Not absolute intelligence, but a particular time kind of focused intelligence.
What book makes you laugh?
Three Men in a Boat made me laugh. Jerome K. Jerome. Bertie Wooster, you know, some of the lines. His satire on Britain and clever observation.
What film makes you laugh, John?
I love The Great Race. I like Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon in that. I thought that was very funny. Anything that the Marx Brothers were in is very funny. Blazing Saddles is very funny. Cat Ballou, Mel Brooks, The Producers, loads and loads.
Brilliant answers. All of those films are hilarious. And we've never had anybody who's given reeled off so many so quickly. Wonderful. Let's take a shift to the other side, because it's very relevant to these times. What is not funny?
What's going on in Russia at the moment is not funny. And Ukraine, Russia as a country is not funny. Some of what went on in America recently with Trump is not funny. The growth of totalitarianism is not funny. Authoritarian leadership is not funny.
No, I couldn't agree more, to be honest with you. As a son of a Hungarian refugee, it's all hitting home quite severely. What word makes you laugh?
Bollocks.
No, what word makes you laugh? Oh, so, what sound makes you laugh, John?
I think a lot of, things going bang, things going pop. I mean, there's a lot of very, if you watch the early Chaplin films, there is a lot of humour in fairly basic. It has to be quite sudden and unexpected, doesn't it? Sudden and unexpected things make me laugh. They're the sounds that make me laugh, I suppose, yeah. They can sometimes frighten you, but they can also make you laugh if something happens at an inappropriate moment. Farts make you laugh on occasions, don't they?
Or when your bollocks go bang.
Well, that's no... Someone who's had a prostatectomy does not laugh about things like that.
OK, I take it back. Would you rather be considered clever or funny?
Both. I'm greedy.
OK, you can have both. And finally, John, desert island gags. You can only take one joke with you to a desert island. What is it?
Well, I liked Jimmy Tarbuck's joke about the honeymoon that Margaret Thatcher didn't like. I have to say, I've told that a few times. And there was a really inappropriate joke, which it did make me laugh, but it reveals me as Republican and capable of saying things at the wrong time. So I'm not going to tell that. That's private.
Okay, so you're going to go with the Jimmy Tarbuck one?
I'll go with that, yeah.
Brilliant. John, you've not only been a fascinating guest, but you've actually improved my mind and my humour. Thank you so much for being a guest on the Humorology podcast.
you lie with effortless ability, Paul, and good luck to you. I've enjoyed it. Thanks.
The Humorology Podcast was hosted by Paul Barros and produced by Simon Banks. Music by Steve Hayworth, creative direction by Les Hughes, and additional research by Helen Sykes. Please remember to subscribe, like, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. This has been a Big Sky production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.